awesome way to
do it. Radio.
$1 trillion flow from LA to Miami, Minnesota to Detroit, Chicago, Alabama, Texas. $1 trillion flow.
Influence of the radio announcer on the community. But while the establishment was quick to blame the tragedy of Watts, most unjustly, on the slogan of Magnificent Montague, it have not been ready to acknowledge all of the positive features which grow out of your contribution to the community. No one knows the importance of tall Paul White and the massive nonviolent demonstrations of the youth of Birmingham in 1963. Are the funds raised by Purvis Spann for the Mississippi Summer Project of 1964? Are the consistent fundraising and voter education done for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Civil Rights Movement by Georgia Wood, my good friend of Philadelphia? Tonight I want to say thank you, not just to these few, but to all of you who have given leadership to our people in thousands of unknown and unsung ways. We would certainly not have come so far without your support. And in a real sense, you have paved the way for social and political change by creating a powerful cultural bridge between black and white. School integration is much easier now that they shared a common music, a common language, and enjoy the same dances. You introduced youth to that music, created the language of soul, and promoted the dance which now sweeps across race, class, and nation. It is quite amazing to me to hear the joyful rhythms which I found time to enjoy as a youth here in Atlanta years ago, coming back across the Atlantic with an English accent, to see the Senator Javits and the Senator Kennedy's lost in the dances which we created. Yes, you have taken the power which old Sam had buried deep in his soul and throughout amazing technology performed a cultural conquest that surpasses even Alexander the Great and the culture of classical Greece. But my brothers and my sisters, we are on the beginning. We still have a long, long way to go. And I would like to share with you the burden on my heart about the problems which still confront us. And if I would use a subject for what I would like to say to you this evening, I would call it transforming a neighborhood into a brotherhood. I want to try to tell you the truth tonight. I want to speak honestly and frankly about many problems that we face in our nation and that we face in the world. For America sorely needs to hear the truth at this time. And I still believe that freedom is the bonus you receive for telling the truth. As Jesus said, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Transforming a neighborhood into a brotherhood. Now there can be no gainsaying of the fact that America has brought the nation and the world to an awe-inspiring threshold of the future. We've built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We've built gargantuan bridges to span the seas and gigantic buildings to kiss the skies.
Did you know that the thyroid test most doctors have you do doesn't paint the whole picture? It's taking...
Through our airplanes, we've walked distance and placed time in chains. And our jet planes have literally compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and months. Bob Hope talked about this new jet age in which we live once. He said it is an age in which it is possible to take a nonstop flight from Los Angeles, California to New York City, a distance of about 3,000 miles. And if on taking off in Los Angeles you develop hiccups, you will hick in Los Angeles and cup in New York City. You know, it is possible because of the time difference to take a nonstop flight from Tokyo, Japan on Sunday morning and arrive in Seattle, Washington on the preceding Saturday night. And when your friends meet you at the airport and ask when you left Tokyo, you will have to say, I left tomorrow. This is what our nation has done through the invention of the Wright brothers right on down to the present day. Yes, through our spaceships, we've literally carved highways through the stratosphere. And through our submarines, we've penetrated oceanic depths. All of this is a dazzling picture of modern man's scientific and technological progress. But what I want to say to you tonight, my friends, is that when we look to the other side, something basic is missing. We suffer from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. We've learned to swim the seas like fish, and to fly the air like birds, and yet we have not learned the simple art of walking the earth as brothers and sisters. And this is the great dilemma facing America. And you know, it comes to this point now. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. Now, there are three things that we must deal with if we are going to transform this neighborhood into a brotherhood. We've got to deal with the problem of racism. We've got to deal with the problem of economic injustice, of poverty. And we've got to deal with the problem of war. Now, let me start out talking about racism. And more, we've got to tell the truth to America about this problem. And the truth means saying to our nation that the roots of racism are very deep in America, and they are still here. And that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. Now, admittedly, we've made some strides, we've made some progress, but this shouldn't cause any of us to become apathetic or lax or complacent. For me, we must recognize that the plant of freedom has grown only a bud and not yet a flower. And the problems that we face are still very serious. Now we hear a lot of talk these days about the so-called white backlash. I want to tell you what the white backlash really is. It's nothing new. It's merely a new name for an old phenomenon. It is a continued expression of the same vacillation, the same ambivalence that's characterized white society from the very founding of this nation. On the Statue of Liberty, we read that America is the mother of exiles. But it doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the mother of its white exiles from Europe. She has not evinced the same maternal care and concern for her black exiles who were brought to this country in chains from Africa. And it is no wonder that our slave foreparents could think about it and they could start singing in a beautiful soul song, in a beautiful sorrow song. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. It was this sense of estrangement and rejection that caused our forebears to use such a metaphor. You see, what has happened is that our nation has constantly made a positive step forward on civil rights, but it has usually simultaneously made a step backwards. There has never been a single solid, determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans on the question of genuine equality for the black man. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery through the Emancipation Proclamation. But he wasn't given any land to make that freedom meaningful.
Dip into Raising Cane's when you crave something hot and fresh and oh-so delicious. Dip in for cooked-to-order chicken fingers, crispy crinkle-cut fries, and garlicky buttered Texas toast. Our secret cane sauce makes every dip a delight.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love.
You know, it was something like having a man unjustly imprisoned for 30 or 40 years, and suddenly you discover that he's innocent, that he's been unjustly jail for 30 or 40 years, and then you simply go up to the man and say, now you are free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to buy any clothes to put on his back. You don't give him any money to get on his feet so that he can rise up once more as a man. But this is what happened to the black man in America. We must remember this, that at the very same time when America refused to give the black man anything, just said you're free, he was left penniless, illiterate, standing out in a situation not knowing what to do and where to go. But we must not forget that at the same time the Negro was being treated like this. America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest. It says that our country was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor, but it refused to undergird its black peasants who were brought in chained from Africa with an economic floor. And so emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without a roof over their heads. Freedom without bread to eat. freedom without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine at the same time. And it is a miracle that the Negro has survived. But the white backlash didn't stop there. In 1875, the nation passed the Civil Rights Bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed an even weaker Civil Rights Bill, and even to this day has failed to enforce it in all of its dimensions. In 1954, the Supreme Court declared segregation unconstitutional in the public schools. And today, less than 10% of the Negro students of the South are attending integrated schools, which means that we have made 1% progress a year, and if it continues at this rate, it will take another 94 years to integrate the schools. Suburban politicians talk eloquently against open housing, and at the same time, or in the same breath, they contend that they are not racist. All of this tells us, my friend, that the white backlash is nothing new. The fact is that America has been backlashing on the question of genuine equality for the black man for more than 300 years. And this is something that we must realize and that we must see. And this is why I say to you that our job is still difficult. We still need your voices. We still need your support. And there isn't any way to solve this problem without pressure. There isn't any way to solve the problem of racial injustice without persistent, nonviolent pressure. There have been those who felt that it could be done another way. That was a great man in our history, and I do not come to you to criticize him tonight, because I think he was a sincere man. His name was Booker T. Washington. Mr. Washington believed that the problem could be solved through pressureless persuasion. He sincerely felt that. He felt that if you didn't push things too fast and if you didn't bother the white South, if you didn't try to make the white man do something that he didn't want to do at that particular time, he would ultimately come around. Mr. Washington sincerely felt this, but he misread history. He did follow that approach. He started saying everything that the white people wanted to hear. He was honored for it. He was called the responsible leader. You know, I always get a little worried when I'm referred to as a responsible leader, because so often when some people call you a responsible leader, they are really telling you that you are a leader who will not tell the truth on behalf of your people. So often they mean that you are a leader more concerned about your budget than you are concerned about the freedom of your people. So often they really mean that you are a leader willing to say to the white power structure what they want to hear rather than what they ought to hear. Booker T. Washington went on with the notion of pressureless persuasion. And the reactionary forces of the white South used that only to plunge deeper into the oppression of the Negro. He told us to let our buckets down where we were, and the problem was that there wasn't much water in the well. And somewhere we must come to see that we must rise up, stand on our own 2 feet, say to our white brothers that we are determined to be men. This is what the movement is saying. We are somebody. We are determined to gain our freedom. And we are going to start with ourselves by freeing our own psyche, our own souls. This is where we've got to start first. Well, you see, in the final analysis, if we're going to be truly free, nobody else can do that for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do that for us. No Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do that for us. If we are going to be truly free, we must reach down into the inner depths of our being and sign with the pen and ink of assertive manhood our own Emancipation Proclamation. And we must come to say, yes, I'm black. I'm black but beautiful. I'm somebody. I have a rich and noble heritage, however exploited and painful it has been. And I've made a contribution to it. And so the responsibility is broad and it is wide. There's a need now for repentance. And this is the only way that we are going to transform this neighborhood into a brotherhood. Now, the final thing I want to talk about, and I've talked longer than I expected, but I've got to bring this out. I believe in telling the truth. We're going to transform this neighborhood into a brotherhood. We've got to get rid of war. John Fitzgerald Kennedy said on one occasion that mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. There's a war taking place today in a little Asian country. The tragedy is that it is the most powerful, the richest nation in the world that happens to be a predominantly white nation, at war with one of the smallest, poorest nations that happens to be a colored nation. We all know the physical casualties, the nightmarish physical casualties of that war. We see them. We see the rice fields of that little Asian country being trampled at will and burned at will. We see crying mothers with little babies tightly clutched in their arms as they stand and watch their little huts burst forth into flames. We see fine young men from our own nation dying in mounting numbers, being wounded every day. We see Vietnamese boys and girls, men and women dying every day. We see little children being burned with napalm. But that isn't all that's happening as a result of that war. That war in Vietnam has isolated our great nation morally and politically. There isn't a single ally, made the ally of the United States, would dare send a troop to Vietnam. The allies that have been with us in other wars in the past aren't there. Today we stand without any friends in the world where this war is concerned, with the exception of a few puppet client nations like Taiwan, Thailand, South Korea, and that's about it. War has damaged our image in the world. It's strengthened the military-industrial complex in our country, and it's strengthened the forces of reaction. It's diverted attention from civil rights. All of the emotions and all of the energies and all of the resources that should be going into civil rights to solve the problems of our cities are so often going into that war. And here we are fighting two wars. A war against poverty, which ends up not even being a good skirmish against poverty, and a war in Vietnam. And we are losing both of them, morally and politically. This war in Vietnam places us in the position of being against the self-determination of the Vietnamese people. And just a little history will tell you what I mean here. In 1945, the Republic of Vietnam declared itself independent after the joint occupation of the French and the Japanese. Incidentally, this was before Communist China came into being. And the interesting thing is, when they declared themselves independent, they quoted our own Declaration of Independence in that document of freedom and applied for membership in the French Commonwealth. And then you remember what happened after that. The French sought to recapture their former colony. And they engaged in a war for 8 years, a brutal war. But France didn't fight that war alone, trying to put those people back into colonialism. It was our country that supported it to the tune of more than $3 billion. And toward the end of the war, we were meeting more than 80% of the war costs. And even when the French came to their senses and started to tire of their reckless action, even before their defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, we tried to urge them to go on. And when the Geneva Accord was reached in 1954, we did everything possible to sabotage it. I have to tell you the truth tonight, my friends. We helped install a man by the name of Diem as premier. The Geneva Accord said that there would be elections in 1956. Mr. Diem got in office and said, there will not be any elections in 1956. And they were not held. He turned out to be one of the most ruthless dictators of modern history. And for those who want to continue to lie to the American public, I wish you would go back and tell them that the Viet Cong did not start in the North. Started as a resistance movement in the South to the oppressive tactics of Mr. Diem. And the North did not start sending supplies and troops in the South until our country escalated that war. And it is necessary to say, my friend, these are facts that must be known, and I say to you that you won't get them in the newspaper. They are not there. Dr. Bernard Paul, one of the great authorities on Vietnam, who was killed not long ago in a plane crash, said less than 25% of the members of the Viet Cong were communists. Yet the American public was brainwashed into believing that this was communist aggression, a communist attempt to take over the world. And at the same time, nobody would say to that same American public that if it was a communist takeover, why is it that Soviet Russia doesn't have a single fighting troop in Vietnam? Why is it that China doesn't have a single fighting troop in Vietnam? And yet we are 10,000 miles away from home with 500,000 troops and getting ready to add more and take some of you and my tax to do it. What we've got to see is that the people in Vietnam are fighting for something else. They have no love for China. Animated by nationalism and a desire for self-determination, not by communism, basically. And this is what has not been said. But not only did we support Mr. Diem, we supported another 12 military dictatorships, and finally we supported a man named Mr. Key. That's who we're supporting now. Now in America, in the civil rights movement, we would call him an Uncle Tom. And we would call him an Uncle Tom because Mr. Key fought against his own people as a mercenary with the French. Mr. Key was the man who said that Hitler was his supreme hero of history, and he's never changed it to this day. This is who we are supporting. I came by here to tell you the truth about it tonight. So we put ourselves in the position of being against the self-determination of a people. And it's time now that we see this. And it's hurt our humility. It's left us with the notion that we are to be the policemen of the world, that we have some divine messianic power to patrol the whole world. And we have even set our own house in order. Senators and congressmen will vote joyously to send billions of dollars to Vietnam. And many of those same congressmen will vote against the fair housing bill, which will make it possible for a veteran from Vietnam who happens to be a Negro to live anywhere that he wants to live when he comes back home. Negroes and white boys will fight in brutal solidarity on the battlefields of Vietnam, but when they get back home, it's doubtful that their children will be able to sit together in the same classroom because most of the schools in this country are segregated. Negro soldiers will die in Vietnam, and sometime they'll come back home to be buried in Wetumpka, Alabama, and can't even be buried there. It's time to set our own house in order. The other thing is we've increased the possibilities as a result of this war for World War III. And there's a danger now if we keep it going. The whole of mankind will be annihilated because of the power, destructiveness of nuclear weapons of warfare. If we continue to flirt unhesitatingly with war, our earthly habitat would be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. And I call now upon our nation to make an honest confession. Oh, I have to do it on my knees at night. I make mistakes tactically. I make mistakes morally. I get on my knees and confess it and ask God to forgive me. The thing that I still love about President Kennedy, and I'm sorry he isn't with us today, is that he had the ability to say, I made a mistake. When he allowed the Bay of Pigs invasion to take place in Cuba, he said, I made a mistake. I never should have listened to the experts. And the time has come now for President Johnson and our government to say to the world, we made a mistake in Vietnam. My friends, I'm about through now, but I want to say that I come to you to say this tonight because I want you to know my views, because you are the persons who so often interpret them. And I want you to hear them. I wanted you to hear them from my mouth. Now, a lot of people, you know, they say a lot of funny things and a lot of things they really believe. There are those who say, now, why don't you stick to civil rights? Aren't you hurting the civil rights movement by taking a stand against the war in Vietnam? I've said to them so often, before I became a civil rights leader, I was a preacher of the gospel. I take that ministry seriously. When I was ordained to the ministry, it was a commission. Bring the moral and ethical insights of our Judeo-Christian heritage to bear on the social evils of our day. And I could not remain silent as I saw what was happening in Vietnam. And for those who say to me, stick to civil rights, I have another answer. And that is that I've fought too long and too hard now against segregated public accommodations to end up segregating my moral concerns. I'm not going to do that. Others can do what they want to do. That's their business. Other civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration. That's their business. But I must say tonight that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And it would be rather absurd for me to be working for integrated schools and integrated other things and not be concerned about the survival of a world in which to integrate. Somebody said to me not long ago, aren't you hurting the cause and hurting your own budget, and don't you think now that you're going to have to start talking more in terms of the administration's policy in Vietnam, because many people who once respected you will lose respect for you? And I looked in that brother's face and I said, I'm sorry, you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I don't determine what is right and wrong by sitting down looking at the budget of SCLC and seeing how many of the contributors may not agree. Oh, no. Sure, my stand has hurt the budget. I don't determine what is right and wrong by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a sucker for consensus, but he's a molder of consensus. And on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And then vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? There comes a time when one must take a stand. That's neither safe, nor politic, nor popular. But he must take it because it is right. And that's where I stand today. And I do it because I love America. I'm not on a Hate America campaign. I love this nation. I've been disappointed with it so often, but there can be no great disappointment where there's not great love. So I stand up against racism. I stand up against poverty and war because they are evil and because I want our nation to solve all of these problems. And I say to you in conclusion that I'm not in despair. I'm going on with a faith in the future. I couldn't work if I didn't have that faith. These have been difficult days for all of us. But I go on with the faith that we're going to get there. By and by, even on the race question, I go on with the faith that this problem can and will be solved. Our goal is freedom. And I believe we're going to get there because however much America has strayed away from it, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be as a people, our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton kings. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most oppressive and humiliating conditions, and yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. And if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We are going to win our freedom. We are going to win our freedom. We're going to win our freedom. And therefore, my friends, I can still say we shall overcome. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold wrong, forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. And so let us keep moving. Let us keep climbing. Let us not allow anything to stop us as we move toward the goal of peace, the goal of brotherhood. A great, noble black bard who left us a few days ago, but who will go down in history for his eloquent pen, Langston Hughes, had a mother to utter some words to her son. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Cat taxman, boards torn up places with no carpet on the floor, there. But all the time I've been up climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you stop now. Don't you sit down on the steps because you find this kind of hard. But I'm still going, boy. I'm still climbing. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Well, life for none of us has been a crystal stair. We must keep moving. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But by all means, keep moving.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank to our host this evening, RCA Victor Record Company, for giving us the opportunity of hearing. Thank each of you for coming, and may we close with the expression, God bless Martin Luther King. And help welcome our honored, distinguished guest, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
Williams,
members of the faculty and members of the student body of Barrett Junior High School, ladies and gentlemen. I need not pause to say how glad I am to be here today and to have the opportunity of taking a brief break in a pretty busy schedule in the city of Philadelphia to share with you the students of Barrett Junior High School. And I want to express my personal appreciation to the principal and the administration for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to see this very fine and enthusiastic group of students here at Barrett. I guess I ought to start out with a commercial, and that is tonight we're going to have a great night in the city of Philadelphia at the Spectrum. I know you've heard of that new impressive structure called the Spectrum. And I know you've heard of Harry Belafonte and Aretha Franklin and Nipsey Russell and Sidney Poitier and all of these other great and outstanding artists. Well, they're going to be here tonight at the Spectrum. And I hope that each of you will go home and tell your parents to be there tonight for this great Freedom Festival. And I hope you will come also, for it will be a great experience. And by coming, you will be supporting the work of the civil rights movement. Now that I've gotten the commercial out of the way, I'll move on and say some things that I want to say very briefly. And I'm being very honest. I'm going to be brief because I have other engagements. I don't have a tradition of being brief all the time. You know, I'm a Baptist preacher. We can talk a long time. But I'm going to really be brief today. I want to ask you a question, and that is, what is in your life's blueprint? This is the most important and crucial period of your lives, for what you do now and what you decide now at this age may well determine which way your life shall go. And whenever a building is constructed, you usually have an architect who draws a blueprint. And that blueprint serves as the pattern, as the guide, as the model for those who are to build the building. And a building is not well erected without a good, sound, and solid blueprint. Now, each of you is in the process of building the structure of your lives. And the question is whether you have a proper, a solid, and a sound blueprint. And I want to suggest some of the things that should be in your life's blueprint. Number one in your life's blueprint should be a deep belief in your own dignity, your own worth, and your own somebodyness. Don't allow anybody to make you feel that you are nobody. Always feel that you count. Always feel that you have worth and always feel that your life has ultimate significance. Now, that means that you should not be ashamed of your color. You know, it's very unfortunate that in so many instances, our society has placed a stigma on the Negro's color. You know, there are some Negroes who are ashamed of themselves. Don't be ashamed of your color. Don't be ashamed of your biological features. Somehow you must be able to say in your own lives and really believe it, I am black but beautiful. And believe it. And therefore, you need not be lured into purchasing cosmetics advertised to make you lighter. Neither do you need to process your hair to make it appear straight. I have good hair, and it's as good as anybody else's hair in the world. And we've got to believe it. Now, in your life blueprint, be sure that you have that a principle of somebody. Secondly, in your life's blueprint, you must have as a basic principle the determination to achieve excellence in your various fields of endeavor. You're going to be deciding as the days and the years unfold what you will do in life, what your life's work will be. And once you discover what it will be, set out to do it and to do it well. And I say to you, my young friends, that doors are opening to each of you. Doors of opportunity are opening to each of you that were not open to your mothers and to your fathers. And the great challenge facing you is to be ready to enter these doors as they open. Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great essayist, said in a lecture back in 1871 that if a man can write a better book or preach a better sermon or make a better mousetrap than his neighbor, even if he builds his house in the woods, the world will make a beaten path to his door. That has always been true, but it will become increasingly true. And so I would urge you to study hard, to burn the midnight oil. I would say to you, don't drop out of school, and I understand all of the sociological reasons why we often drop out of school. But I urge you, in spite of your economic plight, in spite of the situation that you are forced to live so often with intolerable conditions, stay in school. And when you discover what you're going to be in life, set out to do it as if God Almighty called you at this particular moment in history to do it. And just don't set out to do a good Negro job, but do a good job that anybody could do. Don't set out to be just a good Negro doctor, a good Negro lawyer, a good Negro school teacher, a good Negro preacher, a good Negro barber or beautician.